Hey, welcome to Dialogue Outlast Podcast. I'm Ryan Shoemaker here with Joe Plicka, and we're co-fiction editors at Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. We're happy to announce the recent release of the spring 2025 issue of Dialogue, packed with intriguing scholarly work, poetry, fiction, personal essays, and book reviews. As fiction editors, it's our great pleasure today to speak with Derek Jepson, an esteemed writer in the world of Mormon letters, whose flash fiction piece, I Dreamed of Oil, appears in the latest issue of Dialogue. Derek is the author of Biuk and Just Julie's Fine. He's the author of many short stories, poems, and essays. Derek also has a podcast co-hosted with Aaron Brewster called Face in Hat. So, Derek, welcome to the podcast this evening.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, it's good to finally meet after all of these years. I feel like we've been in this sphere of Mormon letters, but have never spoken face-to-face.
Like comets on an orbit that's a couple decades off.
Yeah, yeah. So could we start out, what's your professional and personal background?
So I teach high school. I have for quite a while. I thought when I started teaching high school, I would probably do it for a few years and then go to grad school. And I thought that moving to Berkeley and being in a ward surrounded by PhD students would, expedite that. But actually being surrounded by PhD students like cured me of that. And so I've stayed in high school. I'm very happy teaching high school. I like doing it a lot. It does eat a lot of time. And so that does cut into writing, but I don't know. I like doing it. So that's what I do professionally. I forget what the second half of your question was.
No, and then kind of your personal background too, where you grew up.
Yeah, I lived in southeastern Idaho till I was 10. Then my family moved to California, and I've been in California most of the time since then. I did graduate from BYU, but I've lived by now I'm getting older, so the years are adding up, and every year I'm in California makes the majority all that greater. I'm definitely a California kid.
Yeah. Well, you have the weather there, and Joe grew up in California.
Not too far away. Yeah. Davis.
Oh, Davis. Yeah. Just up the freeway. Yeah. But you didn't get the good weather.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I noticed at what point were you teaching high school relative to when you were working in journalism?
Yeah, I worked as a journalist when I first moved back to California, my wife and I, after following BYU. And then I got a job in a public high school. I may be the only person you meet who decided to teach in public schools for the money. But journalism was in a sorry state then, and it's not that much better now.
Can absolutely relate. There's kind of this weird parallel here. I moved back to California after graduating from BYU and worked at the Davis Enterprise. I'd done a little bit for them in high school, and anyways, ended up working for them and their sister paper in Fairfield. And yeah, totally. After about 2 years, year and a half, I was like, I'm not only am I not going to make any money, I'm just going to be rewriting press releases basically. Yeah. That's when I decided to go back to school, which sometimes I wish someone had cured me of before I did, like you. But but yeah, so you were the editor of the Tehachapi News. Is it Tehachapi?
Tehachapi. Yeah, just briefly. While the main editor was out for surgery, I was the editor. But it was a very small staff. So
yeah, I bet there's some fun stories that came out of that.
Yeah, it was sometime I've saved everything I did. Not very much of it is really worthy of future publication, but there are a couple features I wrote which might deserve to see the light of day someday.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Well, and then inquiring minds want to know, how did Eric become Theric?
Ah.
What's the story there?
Yeah. So I served a mission in Korea, and somehow, I don't remember exactly how, but it certainly fits in with my sort of egotistical persona that I developed in high school. I became the amazing Elder Jepson, at least in English. And when I came home, I don't know how common this experience is, but like my first name didn't feel like my name anymore. Like Eric was just didn't feel right. It didn't feel like mine. I but I couldn't be elder anymore. That would have been stripped away from me. And so I kept the amazing, but that was a little too egotistical, and it shortened itself to Thmazing, which is still my, you know, that's how you can find me on social media, is I'm Thmazing. But that's a ridiculous name also. And so Theric became my professional name. When I went to BYU my first semester, I was a transfer student. My first semester, every class I was in had at least four other Erics. So I just switched entirely to Theric for the rest of my time at BYU. The few people who met me before I changed my name still call me that. But you can tell when people got to know me and how they got to know me by whether they call me Eric or Theric.
It's I like the way to avoid solicitors too, I imagine, right? You know who your true friends are.
That could be, yes. All those clamoring fans that don't know my real name. Right.
Maybe it's because I've been looking at it for so long, but it just, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's just a real name. It's like Scandinavian. It's got a good Viking feel to it.
Yeah. It's, there's a Theric in, I want to say Swedish, but one of the Scandinavian names is a delicacy. It's a way of, it's a dish made from, literally, it's basically just a sheep head. It's basically all it is, just on a plate.
Yeah.
The fur's been taken off, but otherwise, it at least based on the photos, just looks like a sheep head. So
well, that's your wrestling name.
Sheep head. So any Theric children you'd ever meet, you know in some way that you would you have inspired a name. Because all of my kids' names come from names that I read about in stories for workshops. So
oh, that's great.
You never know. There might be a lot of Therics running around out there. A lot of fans of your work.
Yeah. When that happens, when one of my students is named Theric, then I'll really flip out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, your name, right? It's gonna take off here anytime now. So, I mean, yeah, for years, like I've seen this name, right? Theric Jepson and in Mormon letters. So I'm curious to know, like, how did you find your way into the world of Mormon letters?
It's a good question. I don't exactly know, because there was a time when I was too good for it. Like most people in Mormon letters, I think most of us had a moment where we thought that was no good. I think what happened is I graduated from BYU. I had a teacher who was president of the AML, so I'd heard of it, the Association for Mormon Letters, for those listening not in the know. And I graduated, and my wife delayed her graduation. We were going to graduate together. That didn't happen, so I was kind of caught in this limbo. I was working a crappy job. My mind was used to like collegiate level thinking, and I had nothing to do. And I got on the AML list and just started communicating with people and found a lot of value there. That crappy job I had a coworker who was an LDS kid going to BYU, big cinephile, huge cinephile. And the job we had was to take stickers off of VHS boxes. So we put new stickers onto VHS boxes so they could be rented at grocery stores. This is a job that does not exist anymore. But we got Brigham City. We got Brigham City in. And on the back of the Brigham City VHS box, it has this quotation from some critic that compares it as like the greatest debut, or well, not debut, but like the greatest indie noir or something since Blood Simple by the Coen brothers. And it blew the kid's mind because he was convinced that there could not be good Mormon art, even though he himself was Mormon and he loved movies. The idea that there could be a good Mormon movie, just like he just couldn't comprehend that. The quotation really upset him. He couldn't, I don't think he ever watched the movie because he just couldn't believe it, but it upset him that somebody had said that because it just confused his. And that's always really, that I think clarified for me the importance of working. I mean, I don't only do Mormon stuff, but I think it's important to be part of whatever niches you are a part of and build the literature wherever you stand, because every culture deserves good writing. And, you know, making money has never been a huge priority for me, so why not Mormon letters?
And are you discovering like an audience for your work outside the kind of Mormon culture?
That's an interesting question. I get little hints of that every once in a while that they exist, that there are readers out there, but not a lot. And because it's not my job per se, I treat it pretty professionally in terms of how much work I put into it and how much I try to publish. But because I'm not worried about the money so much, I don't really, you know, I'm not pursuing metrics or anything. So every once in a while I'll get a hint that somebody is paying attention, and that's flattering, but I don't pay enough attention to know. I mean, I'm not making any money, so I'm going to guess it's not that much.
That's a coincidence, because I'm not making any money either. Joe, what about you?
not doing anything like this, that's for sure.
Labors of love.
So labors of love.
So Theric, yeah, so let's talk about your story and dialogue, I Dreamed of Oil. And what we were kind of hoping is that maybe you could just give us a brief summary of the story as best you can, and then just read a short excerpt from it, and then we can discuss.
Sure. Or do you mind if I go in the opposite order?
Whatever order.
And then summarize the rest?
Sure.
I'll read the opening, and I'll sort of summarize where it goes from there. So this is I Dreamed of Oil. I don't know who was sick. Maybe it was you. Let's say it was. You were sick, and I was probably more worried than you, as per usual. But we brought our faith to our prayers, and we pled that you would be healed. I anointed your head with oil, and I sealed that anointing and blessed you. This was the last of our oil, and you were healed. Later, I was not there, but later you were telling this story to an apostle. And the apostle took a container of oil, about 6 inches high and of curious workmanship, blown glass, clearly, but into such an astonishing shape, it appeared the oil was twisting into the air like God and his pillar. And he blessed that oil and gave it to you. Now, there's nothing in my thigh. I'll let Daniel edit that. Now, there's nothing in my theology, and I believe nothing in yours, that would lead us to believe that oil blessed by an apostle is any holier than oil blessed by, say, me. But you and I couldn't help but marvel at the container and its holy oil, a twinge of celebrity worship infecting our religious feeling. And then, somehow, and we've never quite been able to work out how this happened, but somehow, the container was uncapped and tipped over and pouring its contents upon my body. That's how it starts. He discovers that for all his belief that oil is oil is oil, having this apostolic oil poured upon his body makes him holy in some way, and he's able to heal people. But he doesn't have the courage to really try to change anything. He's happy to hold a colicky baby and take away their crying or to cure someone's promenade acne. But anything more than that is he's afraid that it might break his faith or not, or break the faith of the person who comes to him. And so he's nervous about that. And then just as the title promises, and just as the uncertainty of the first paragraph promises, he wakes up and he discusses this with the person he is in bed with. And that's the story. As you said, it's very flash. It's quite short.
Mm-hmm. Flash, but just packed full of, meaning and beautiful images. So I'm always curious to know, like, what was the kernel of this story, even the autobiographical kernel of it? Because I always teach my students, right, that there's always something of them, or there should be something of them in their work. And if there probably isn't, it probably is empty. So yeah, like, what's the kernel of this work?
Well, let me tell you a mission story first, and then I'm going to give you the answer to your question, which I think might be disappointing. But when I was in my first area of my mission, so I'm a new missionary. I'm really trying to be a good missionary. And I'm coming down with the flu or something, right? It sucks. I've been in the mission maybe a couple weeks, and I'm starting to get sick. And I'm like, this can't happen. I can't be a good missionary and sick at the same time. So that morning, I pray with an unusual amount of faith that I'll be healed. And I can immediately feel my body start to be healed. And like Peter on the water, I freak out and I'm like, no. Like I don't know that I actually want that to happen. Right. I don't need my faith is not such that I want to be healed immediately. And then I feel myself starting to get sick again. I was like, no, like Peter, cause I, I thought of Peter. I was like, I got to stick with this. And I, it did feel very miraculous, and I was healed and I was not sick. I was fine, but I've never had the faith to attempt that again. It's just, it feels dangerous to even try to do that. So I think that experience, which feels like a really important one to me, even though I'm not sure I learned the right lessons from it, I feel like that's at the, probably somewhere at the core of the story. But the truth of the matter is that January of last year, I woke up one morning and I had had this dream and I wrote it down. And I hate that story because I don't think that's how fiction should work. But that's exactly what happened. Actually, there were two stories. I woke up, and I don't usually do this. I'm not sure I've ever published a story that's based on a dream before, but that morning I woke up with two stories and I published them both. I like found homes for them within a matter of just a few months, which is not usually how things work at all. And I hate telling that story because it's the wrong message, but that's what happened.
Well, we all deserve a freebie once in a while, right? Like, and I was going to say, I was going to raise my hand and say, me, I know the answer to that question. Cause I can't believe Ryan, we've both been traveling and I didn't have time to message Ryan and let him know that just a couple of days ago, Derek posted to his blog with, I should have sent this to you, Ryan, where it's great. This is like, you know, on the Thutopia blog, there is a little entry about these stories and this kind of process of turning them into fiction from the dream. And, we make appearances in the blog entry as the dialogue editor. So, so you say something here. One weird thing about working from a dream is that it feels more honest to leave the text in its first written form. It felt almost like nonfiction, like I had to respect the truth of the dream, which is an interesting thing, right? Because where you're writing fiction, it's like, well, when you're writing fiction, you don't have to respect the literal truth of anything. And yet there's this, but if you're gonna just, dreams are already this kind of strange magic that sometimes makes sense, sometimes doesn't. And so it's almost like I get it. I don't know how to explain it, but I get it. Like this kind of, idealistic, like I'm going to kind of be true to the weirdness rather than trying to change the weirdness. If I'm going to change the weirdness, I might as well start from scratch. Right. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah. It's when I'm editing people, I often give them this Neil Gaiman quotation. Although he's kind of on the outs now, of course, that when somebody tells you something is wrong with their piece, they're almost always right. But when somebody tells you how to fix it, they're almost always wrong. And so when I'm giving people advice and I'm like reading their story and trying to give them good feedback, one thing I try not to do is tell them exactly how to fix it. I just sort of point out where the weaknesses are or what, you know, whatever needs tweaking. And when I wanted to edit these, it felt a lot like it was somebody else's work. And so I could maybe note, for instance, I knew that I Dreamed of Oil was weaker towards the end, but I didn't feel like I was the writer almost. I didn't feel like I could fix it. So it was really good that you guys accepted the story because your editorial feedback is the only way that I was able to like give myself permission to edit it. Like it, cause it really did. It felt like I was capturing some nonfiction reality, and to change it would be like, yeah, I don't know, lying about how many people are at inauguration or something. You can't do that. That's just not helping it work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, who was that you just quoted? I can't remember. You just
said Neil Gaiman.
Neil Gaiman. Okay. Cause I was going to say there's a Robert Olin Butler, lecture. He has a book called From Where I Dream where he kind of says something similar. He says, when I'm reading a story, it's like I'm listening to somebody strum the guitar and I hear the string buzz or twang, like maybe their finger was just not in the right place. But it's not like, kind of like you're saying, it's not like we're saying, oh, he's not going to say, oh, it's this note or whatever. It's just, hey, there's a twang there, something twanged. I think you're onto something there. But yeah, I mean, we were, you know, Ryan and I saw the story and felt in the immediacy of it. I think the, even though the story is relatively simple also because of its length and straightforward, for me, it lives in this interesting kind of rhetorical situation with the voice and the narrator, who's speaking first about the dream and then about what happens when he wakes up from the dream, and then speaking to a, you know, a beloved at the end, and all those kind of, the way that each of those little rhetorical shifts changes the message, changes the purpose of talking about the dream. For me, it's the voice, right? And and there's so much, I think we're going to get into a little bit, I think, very allegorical kind of meaning to extract from this. I mean, this is, as many literary stories are, right? When you paraphrase it, it starts to feel a little bit like, well, is that it? That's all? He had a dream and then he woke up? Like, that's
right.
But there's something, of course, in the language and the voice that begs a kind of allegorical reading. Maybe I'll leave it to you, Ryan, to kind of lead us into that next.
Yeah, sure.
Moment.
Well, I think it's interesting, you know, as the scriptures are so rich with dreams. You have, you know, just the Old Testament, you have Joseph interpreting dreams, you have Jacob and the dreams of, you know, the latter and Daniel's dream, and in the New Testament, Joseph's dream and the wise men, and then the Book of Mormon, Lehi. And I feel like scripturally, like we take dreams as this kind of repository of meaning. And but I feel in a way like this piece subverts that. Because I think I began reading it thinking like here's a dream, right? Some wisdom will emerge from this. But certainly there's wisdom there that this narrator learns, but I think what emerges is a lot of things about himself that he might not like, right? He has become holy, he's able to heal, but he's reluctant to do it. He discovers, you know, that he has faith in a limited God. So I think that's interesting, right? What he discovers in the dream, maybe some ego, some things about himself that he needs to change to be more Christ-like and to actually kind of share that holiness with others in a more charitable way.
I love that. I think you're really onto something. And I think that works on the macro level as well. As I think about the church at this moment, I don't feel like we're as Joseph Smith-y as we could be. Like there's a lot of, as one example, there's a lot of talk about how, well, nothing more has been revealed about Heavenly Mother, and I don't know what's happening in Salt Lake, but one is not given the impression that we're really trying to find out more. We're really asking and seeking this. Like one does not get that impression. And I wonder if it's because we do feel a little safer with a God we understand. I have a book called The New Testament, which is new translations of a lot of apocryphal New Testament works. And to read Jesus in something that isn't in the four Gospels, where, you know, I've been told a million times since I was a child what the Good Samaritan means or what the 10 virgins are all about. But to read some of these apocryphal works that Jesus allegedly said that are so hard to parse and understand, like, no wonder Jesus was threatening to people. Like, he was crazy and insane. And I'm not saying these things are necessarily deserve as much weight as canonical works, but it was a really eye-opening experience to read them and try to say, oh, well, what if I was hearing the Good Samaritan story for the first time? Would I understand it? Would I be sure that the right answer is what I was taught in primary?
Yeah. Are those the Nag Hammadi texts, the Book of Thomas, the
Gnostic? It includes, it's called the New Testament. It's a pretty great book. It has a beautiful cover, and I'm pretty sure it's everything that's considered contemporary that we have a copy of. It's quite a large book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I thought what was interesting in the, you know, the dream is so, in a way, eye-centric. You know, it's, you know, the narrator kind of taking this upon himself, like to go out and to heal even reluctantly. What I find so beautiful in the end is when he wakes up, there's this movement, right? As he, I assume, like his wife, you know, to ask about her dreams, You know, maybe her dream will be more profound than him. And they get ready for the day, and the I transitions into the we. You know, like we, it's no longer the I am going to go and you know, do these charitable acts, these Christ-like acts, like we're going to do it together. So there's also this beautiful message of inclusivity, right? That it's, you know, this isn't just something, you know, to be holy and to create wholeness. Like, I think wholeness is about connecting with others and being unified in our Christ-like service. And I love right at the end how it's this mission for him and his wife. Like, they're going to go out, right? They're going to do these good things. They're going to bless others, which is right the way that it should be.
Yeah, and a willingness to not really understand what it means to do God's work, but still try to do it anyway. I think that's really important. My new calling, it's the first time I've ever had a stake calling, and I realized that the responsibilities I have, it's actually impossible to do everything I've been asked to do. Like, it's just not possible. And so I'm having to sort of prioritize what I think is important and work on certain things and ignore other things, and which is not something that feels exactly like a scripture hero would do. And yet that's the reality. If you're going to do anything in this life that's complicated and difficult, which is to say anything that's worth doing, you're going to have to make decisions and be willing to fail a lot. And that's okay. Like, you know, try. I love that Beckett line. Like, how does it go? So one of you will be able to quote, I'm sure. Like, try, fail. Yeah, you got it, Joe?
No, I was going to say no. I don't know.
Let me get on chat.
Like, fail better. Is that what it is? Fail better, I think. Oh, try, okay. Fail, fail better. Something like that.
Is that Beckett? I think it's been swallowed by the self-help industry.
Oh, it has. Yeah. It was not such a clean and beautiful thing when Beckett did it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, that kind of reminds me of, I think it's Richard Rohr, you know, where he says any idea of perfection also has to include the idea of imperfection. Like, we find perfection through imperfection, and I think that's what the narrator, right in having this dream, right, he understands, you know, maybe some of his, you know, that he's isolates himself a little bit, that he isn't as bold as he should be, but right rises to the occasion at the end.
Yeah, to me, this is one of the beautiful things about Latter-day Saint doctrine, is this idea that, you know, it doesn't matter how silly we might be, we are children of God, and we are allowed to muddle our way towards perfection. And it's something we all get to do together. And I think there's a lot of beauty in that.
Right. And the, you know, the story, I think, emphasizes this idea that there's, you know, far more potential and power available to us than we both realize and also want to admit. I love what you were saying earlier in your story about it feeling dangerous to have too much faith. Like, that is such a provocative idea. And it's if I may tell one really quick story that I feel like goes perfectly well with that, which is, and this is with Ryan. Ryan and I go way back. We were actually in Jerusalem together at the BYU Jerusalem Center in fall of 1999. And Ryan probably remembers this. There was a man down at the Western Wall of the temple who was kind of like a Christian, apocalyptic Christian preacher. And he was dressed in strange robes and was carrying a suitcase. Do you remember this, Ryan?
He had a gold cummerbund on.
Yeah. And he, and we went and talked to him, and he was telling us how he was there to call the Jews to repentance. But the interesting thing was, he was telling us about how, you know, he'd been there for weeks and he was trying different things, and that he told us, yeah, I came here today and I just had this really strong impression that I was going to thrust my hand into my robe and pull it out, and it would be leprous. And that would be a sign to everybody, to the Jews at the Western Wall, that they were going to pay attention or repent or whatever. But he said, and we're all kind of listening to him going, wow, this guy's kind of nuts. But also, like, how does the story end? And he's like, so I put my hand in my robe and I pulled it out and nothing happened. It didn't work. And am I getting the story wrong? Right. But then he basically said, but I'll be here tomorrow. I'm going to be back tomorrow, you know, trying to figure out how to do this. So however misguided his quest may have been, there was something astonishing about, one, kind of the vulnerability of trying to have that much faith. And then two, also failing to live up to it, failing to, but this kind of simplicity. And I think what I love about the story at the end is this idea, to me at least, you know, as I'm, my personal reading of it kind of speaking to me in this way of, well, no matter how we fail to live up to our true potential and our true privileges as children of God, as, you know, believers of covenant people, whatever, we are always called to simply turn to the person next to us and simply love them. And that's a miracle and that's power. And anyway, so maybe I'm getting a little too saccharine here, but appreciate it.
Well, I am a big believer that whatever readers find is the real thing. Mm-hmm. The story that I had in, actually, are you, I shouldn't say this because I it might not be true, but I want to say you're both in Path in the Glory and Path in the Gate. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the story that it was a story that I had written a while ago and I hadn't typed it up. And when I got the call, I was like, oh, this story would be perfect. So I wrote it and I sent it and I was like, oh, great. Now everybody's going to think that I'm an apostate. Everybody's going to think that, like, I've abandoned the church. And all the feedback I've gotten from the story is that either A, it's so faith affirming, like, thank you so much. Or like, why did you submit something that was just so sweet and innocent? And I'm like, oh, well, you just never know how people are going to read it. So that's okay. And I think that's one of the things that is beautiful about literature is that we can all, like, share an experience, but without sacrificing our own experience. Like, we're there as individuals. And I think novels and fiction generally are perhaps a particularly good example of this, because you spend the time alone with that work of art. But once you've read it, it's something you share with other people who read it. And so it's this very individual and simultaneously very communal experience. And I think I just love that. That's why I'm here.
Absolutely. Words on the page invite co-creation and communal experience. And not that film is also a powerful medium, but the thing with film is it's so saturated and dense with detail that there's less space for you to act as a co-creator. Obviously there's still great, you know, artistic achievement in film and people talk about it and pull their hair out over it. But there's something so spare and weak about words on a page that, ironically enough, kind of invite us into a more powerful place of interpretation and co-creation with the person who put those words there. So even a little flash fiction like this could generate, I'm sure, many more minutes of this discussion and conversation, although maybe we're running up against it, Ryan. I haven't been looking at the clock.
Yes, we're running up against it. So this has been such an incredible conversation, and there's so much more to say. But Theric, so we kind of want to give you some time at the end to just talk about other projects and endeavors you're involved in or working on or that you want to plug right now.
Well, thanks. I am currently the editor of Irriantum, just published Ryan last year. Irriantum is, I think, great. I highly recommend, if people of the dialogue system, if you're not spending time at Irriantum, please come join us. There's lots of great work being published. So I'm very proud of that. I am in the first time in my life in a position where a publisher has asked to see a novel that I haven't written yet. So that's very exciting. I gotta really work on that. I managed to get like 460 words written today. There's something, they didn't give me a deadline. And so paradoxically, I think if I had a deadline, I would be almost done by now, but they didn't give me a deadline. And so somehow that's made it really hard to work on, but I'm excited for the book. And it's not for an LDS publisher, though there are a lot of people, LDS connected people who work there, but but it's about a couple of BYU students who just got married and they're on their way to their honeymoon and they're excited for that stuff. And then they get pulled over by the cops who find a body in the trunk. So it's actually, I think it's also might be commercial fiction, which is very exciting also, but we'll see what happens. Those are the two things I'm working on now, but if you keep, you know, who knows what will come out next. It's the nature of this is lots of little things and you never know when they'll show up. So memorize my name, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we'll look for your Netflix series one of these years. The Mormon couple with the body in the trunk. And I don't know if Joe and I are allowed to say this, but so we were the AML judges last year and we fell in love with just Julie's Fine.
Thank you.
Incredible read. Very enjoyable.
Yeah, and I want to repent, Theric, for I'm just so bad at sending stuff out. I'm scared and lazy, but I'm always thinking to myself, gosh, I should send something to Irriantum. So I'm hopefully will show up in your inbox one of these days. I'm always impressed with just how prolific and kind of how you have your fingers in a little bit of everything. You know, you're showing up on all these blogs. You've got a Substack. You're on social media. You're publishing every genre imaginable. You were winning awards for comics. You're like one of those. There's a few people I know that I've just kind of asked myself, what is this person doing? How do they have more hours in the day than I seem to have, which of course is just a testament to your dedication and work ethic. But anyways, we hope we keep seeing more stuff from you.
Well, thank you. I will take that as a compliment because it's certainly not how I feel. I don't know how you guys, what your teenage selves were like, but I definitely thought I'd be in a different spot today. So there's still room. There's still room for growth.
Well, it sounds like you're writing fiction as you dream at night. So maybe that's what.
Yeah, if I could do that more regularly, then yeah, I'd be done by now.
Oh. Yeah, yeah. Well, Theric, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure. So all of you out there listening, thanks for listening to the Dialogue Out Loud podcast. If you're new to Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, go to dialoguejournal.com for the entire lineup of great podcasts in the Dialogue Podcast Network, where you'll find more interviews, poetry and fiction readings, and even some Sunday school lessons. Dialogue Out Loud is produced and edited by Daniel Foster Smith, and we will see you next time. Take care.
Greetings, my name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.